Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Rob Kientz from Gold Silver Pros. He's been covering the precious metals for 10 years, and he's also a former auditor. How are you today, Rob?
I'm doing fine, Tom. Thank you.
I wanted to start by, let's get a definition for what a future exchange is and why it exists.
Okay, so along the way in my career, I passed a Series 3 commodities license. This is a license provided by the government if you want to get involved in the financial markets. I've also held 63 and 7. So I do have, in addition to being auditor, I do have some financial background in the markets as well. When you take that license, they'll teach you what the futures markets were basically for in the whole commodities exchange. And that's basically to serve as a legitimate hedge for producers and merchants. So they're the main focus. So let's say that you're producing wheat. And you're going to plant the wheat and you're going to spend money on fertilizer and on equipment. And you have to take a bank loan, you know, to pay for the farm and your equipment and all of those things. And all of that goes into your assumptions about how much wheat you want to produce and the fact that you want to produce wheat versus corn, for example. So you make those assumptions and you plant your wheat, but you're worried about, you know, the 2 or 3 or 4 months it takes to grow that wheat between the price falling by the time you get it to the exchange. Let's say you're anticipating $10 a bushel for your wheat, but you're worried about $5 because you're worried about competitors coming from other farms in the area or maybe competitors coming from overseas now that we have global markets and that might depress the price of wheat. So we needed a way to deal with these seasonally fluctuating prices in a lot of our commodities. So we developed this futures market, and the futures market does is it allows speculators to come in and take the other side of trade, of the hedge trade. So a farmer says, I'm worried about the price going from $10 to $5 a bushel. I want to take a short position, meaning I'm betting on the price going down. And if it does actually fall down, I will gain the same amount of money or about the same amount of money I would have had as the loss when I sell it for $5 a bushel. So it protects their prices. And the other side of that trade is a speculator saying, well, I think the price of wheat could actually go up, so I'm going to take the long side of that. And that provides a way for the producer to hedge their price risk between the time that they're producing something and getting it to market. On the other side of that, you have merchants to use a lot of these commodities. Let's say the merchant's going to be using iron, you know, to develop some sort of steel bridge or something. Who knows? But they're worried about the price going up, which would increase their cost of production. So they take a long contract so that the price goes up. They make money in the futures market to offset the rise in price of the iron that they have to buy to deliver their orders when they come in. And the short on that is the speculator in that case, and he's betting that the price of iron may fall, so he takes the short. So that's essentially when they teach you about this and when you take your Series 3 license, that's what they teach you the markets are for. Now, what the futures markets are actually has morphed into something quite a bit different than that. There is much more speculation in some of these commodities on the futures market than there are commodities actually produced in a given month or a given year. And so now what we have is this big, massive paper speculative market that in many cases dwarfs what could be seen as legitimate hedges based on the production numbers and the other side of the equation, how much the merchants are using on a daily, monthly, yearly basis.
Absolutely. And let's just say in this case, I wanted to get you on because you did another interview with Kieran Van Hest, who we had on earlier. And we're really just trying to explore all sides of this COMEX debate. And you have another interesting angle on what the data is. So why don't we start by defining a couple of the opaque definitions of where these discrepancies have come up to do with the COMEX futures market. So let's start with the eligible versus registered categories.
Okay, so this is something that the exchange came up with, I want to say about 2002, 2003, and I'm just going off the charts of when we actually started seeing, and I want to talk about gold and silver. So when we started seeing gold and silver flow into the eligible category, this occurred after the tech crisis. Prior to that, there was no such differentiation between registered and eligible. If you had gold on the exchange, it was assumed that that gold was for use against futures contracts. Now the gold for use against futures contracts is called registered gold. So if somebody's going to put up a contract for delivery and the seller and the buyer agree to that, there's supposed to be metal basically to back that up. And that goes into the registered category. There's a warrant issued against that metal, and whoever holds the warrant or the receipt basically owns title that metal, and it's exchanged when the contract is settled for physical deliveries. The eligible category is just vault stored gold. Now that gold or silver happens to be in the same depository, But remember, these depositories can hold gold and silver that have nothing to do with the exchanges, with the COMEX. It can be just be gold and silver that people want to store there for safety purposes, because that's, I mean, the vaults are perfect for that purpose. If you want to store, you know, $1 million in gold, a COMEX depository is a great place to put it, especially if you originally got it from the COMEX depository. When you get it and you settle that contract, it's no longer unregistered. It's basically ineligible. And so, but eligible gold and silver doesn't necessarily mean it's liquid for on the futures exchange. The person that owns that, the title to that eligible gold or silver, has to tell the exchange, okay, I want to make this available for futures contracts. It's now registered. And that's the difference between the two.
Perfect. And then let's get your thoughts on the open interest category as well.
So open interest is basically the amount of contracts at a point in time that are trading on the exchange. So whether it be a paper contract or a physically delivered contract, that's the open interest in a commodity on the exchange. And that can change. That can change daily, and that can fluctuate up and down, and it can be the result of many, many different settlement of contracts, whether it be physical or paper.
So where are we starting to see these discrepancies, and where are the problems with this market starting to crop up?
So there's one more term that we need to define, and that's volume. And volume is supposed to be the sum of all the trades. We'll use an example here. Let's say you have a river flowing into a lake and the lake is dammed. The lake itself is the total volume of all the water that's flowed up against that dam to form the lake. The open interest would be the stream flow. You know, if it rains, the open interest can be higher. You know, if it's a drought and there's no interest, literally, then the rain could be lower. But whatever has flowed through that system is your volume. So the volume is supposed to track everything.
Volume in and out?
Yeah, it's supposed to be in and out. And that's what the CME website represents. But the CME, when they're talking about volume and open interest, they just take one side of the trade because they don't want to double count, because you're going to have a buyer and a seller, right? So they take each contract. So each contract represents one in both open interest and volume. Now, the problem with the CME website, and I want to be clear here, it's not so much that we're claiming that the CME group is lying about their numbers.
Absolutely.
And I've been criticized about this in the past. When I wrote the article about gold and silver numbers not adding up on their website, I was saying that you couldn't do an accounting between the differences in open interest on a daily basis with the volume, because they don't report the volume. And then there's one more term we have to define: settlement. So settlement can either be paper or physical, according to the CME website. And it's literally a one sentence definition. Contract is settled, paper or physical, that's a settlement. The settlement volume is not reported on the CME website in a way that you can match it up on a daily, monthly, yearly basis. So you can look at the overall volume in a market over time. You can look at the open interest on a given day. The CME only allows 5 days worth of physical delivery data, the daily report, as well as the open interest numbers, and then it rolls off and you can't get it. You can, as I understand it, go to the CME group and pay for that information. There's something called like a block data that you can pay for, and it's quite expensive. So the average everyday analyst is not probably going to be able to afford this unless you own a business or you're one of the traders. So if you want historical data, you can't get it. If you want current data, you can get it, but you can't get all the numbers you need to match. And I liken this to, you know, my audit background. I start off an audit in Sarbanes-Oxley. People may know Sarbanes-Oxley as resulting from Enron. Enron had a lot of accounting irregularities. We said, ooh, this is an issue. Let's come out with some legislation. And Michael Sarbanes and his partner did this called Sarbanes-Oxley. Came out in 2002. In 2004, we started doing our first audits. And I was in the first audits in 2004. And what Sarbanes-Oxley allows us to do is have independent auditors come in and validate numbers. The problem with CME Group is sort of at two levels, and where we say that there are some discrepancies, or at least I call it obfuscation. First, we don't have a balance sheet for the CME Group. You cannot balance all the debits and credits. In other words, both sides of the equation on closed contracts. You can't do it because they subjectively print a lack of volume information. And then the open interest and delivery information, they don't match transactionally. So we lack transactional data. So if I'm an auditor, I'm looking at the balance sheet. I'm like, okay, let me go to the general ledger and get the individual transactions. So the balance sheet has all the aggregate numbers. It has your cash, it has your debt, it has all that stuff. But you have to go to the ledger to see each individual transaction that led to that overall balance sheet. That's what the CME Group is missing. They're missing a ledger. They also don't have an income statement and a statement of cash flows. In this case, a statement of cash flows would more be a statement of transaction flows. Show me all the transactions and how all those numbers add up. They don't have it. And so you can, when you go to the CME Group website, you can't balance anything. That's the first problem. It's obfuscating the data. which really hides what's going on a daily basis. Now, I wanted to point out there's two analysts on Twitter that have challenged me on this and said, you can balance the numbers. And when I approach both of them, not only on Twitter, but where I write at Seeking Alpha as well, when I approach both of them, they admitted, well, you can't really balance the numbers, but we think they're right. And I'm like, it doesn't matter what you think, it's what we can prove. That as an auditor, it's what you can prove. That's what matters.
And we were chatting before about you can't prove it's wrong, but you can't necessarily prove it's right either, right?
Yeah. So I have somebody who's very prominent in the gold space who's actually a dealer. And he said, well, based on the data provided, you can't prove it wrong because the volume data is not provided. And I said, exactly right. So you proved my point. You can't prove it right either. See, that's how that works. So that's the first layer of problems. The second layer of problems is the independent audits. There's some auditing done on physical metals, but there's no auditing done on the actual reporting of the overall trade data by an independent auditor. And even the physical metal audits that are done at the depositories, not the CME group that manages the market, but the depositories actually hold the physical metal, those are never published. So we never get to see them. So we don't know. Those audits could basically say, oh, yeah, all your physical deliveries are completely screwed up. You're wrong, 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 wrong. But it never sees the light of day. Or maybe they're completely correct, but it never sees the light of day. It's like saying we're going to have a SOX audit of a public company because of Enron. We want to make sure that the numbers are correct and there's no fraud. But we're never going to publish a SOX report. You just have to trust us. After Enron, the American public would not have accepted that. That would have been a complete farce. You got to publish the audits. So there is a little bit of auditing done in the CME group, only on the physical, but they're not publishing them. And on the actual trade data, including the paper contracts, there's no audit of that that I know of that even exists, and it's not published.
So, Rob, there's one other part of this that seems questionable that we've seen, and I believe you were saying this happened around April 1st with all of the demand for the physical off of the exchange, was that they doubled the amount of approved suppliers, correct?
Yes. So I think we've talked about the open interest and the way the contracts are and how you can't validate the data. We haven't necessarily gotten to shadow contracts, which you can get into that if you want. Now I think you're switching over to the inventory. So let's talk about the inventories. So on April 1st, there were two reports in the media about the strength of the actual physical metal held on the COMEX. One came from the LBMA, one came on Bloomberg. So the LBMA, they basically stated that at the time on April 1st, there was 9.2, I believe, million ounces total, 5.6 of that eligible, the other 3.5 registered in gold on April 1st. And why the LBMA is attesting to the COMEX, because it's a different market, I have no idea. What spooked people in London that the LBMA had to issue that report and not the COMEX? Why doesn't the COMEX just make the audit reports available so the LBMA doesn't have to issue an opinion on a market that they don't run and they don't regulate? That's the first thing that seems a bit odd. The second was that on Bloomberg, they came out and said, there's an article that said, yeah, we have plenty of metal. There's 3.5 million ounces. We have plenty. That was on April 1st. Okay, fine. At that point, if you had just accepted those attestations from the LBMA and Bloomberg, you would have said there's no reason to worry. We got plenty of metal. We don't need to spook the markets. We don't need to worry about that. 8 days later, and this is I wanted to give credit where it's due. This is reported by Ronan Manley of Bullion Star. So you go to bullionstar.com. You look up Ronan Manley's blog, and I'll give you the link, Tom, so that you have it if your readers want it.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes.
So he published this on April 16th, but he was looking at the April 9th report from the CME group. So go read his blog, and he walks all the way through it in detail, but I'm going to summarize it. On April 9th, 8 days later, after both the LBMA and Bloomberg are trying to assure the public market that we had enough gold in the exchanges to satisfy contracts, the CME group released a memo, essentially. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, Tom, because the CME Group's memo goes on to talk about position limits. Position limits and inventory are not the same thing. And again, it goes to terms. Position limits are the amount of total positions one can take on the exchange, whether short or long. It can be paper, it can be physical. But it's just, it's how many trades can you do? It's not how much metal does the COMEX have. So the title of this is CFT Regulation Certification Notification Regarding Increase of Spot Month Position Limits and Accountability Levels of 5 Gold Futures and Options Contracts. In other words, in the title of this document, it doesn't talk about inventories. And the first half of this document, they're talking about position limits and thinking that's okay. They're just talking about, you know, just regular everyday business, business as usual stuff. But buried within this report, and Ronan Manley found this, I have to give him credit, the exchange dropped a couple of bombshells about inventories. So if you don't mind, I'd like to read from that document straight off of the CME Group website.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so on the second page, third paragraph from the bottom, It says the following. The exchange determined at this time to base its estimates of deliverable supply of gold on eligible and registered stock stored exchange approved depositories. In other words, they had always represented eligible as being deliverable. That's the key. The next sentence says the exchange recognizes that gold is used as an investment vehicle, and as such, some gold stock may be held as a long-term investment. And this is where they start to back out of eligible being deliverable. It goes on to say, while surveys conducted indicate no clear consensus as to how much gold is dedicated to long-term investments, in other words, they're going to the depositories for whom they regulate and saying, how much is eligible gold can we actually say goes into the futures market? And there's no clear consensus. And further, I want to point out in this entire memo, there's no criteria that they have represented that for the last 20 years that they could say how much eligible gold that they had been representing was deliverable, was ever deliverable. What's your criteria? You know, has this been misrepresented since eligible category existed? It seems to be what they're saying. So I'm going to go on and read some more. The exchange, in an effort to represent a conservative deliverable supply that may be readily available for delivery, made a determination at this time to discount from its estimate of deliverable supply 50% of reported eligible gold at this time. 8 days after the LBMA and Bloomberg came out and said, don't worry about the gold, the CME Group, in a paper that's not titled anything to do with inventories, has this bombshell hidden in the paper that says, yeah, well, 50% of our eligible is probably not deliverable. And further, we don't know if any of it's deliverable because we have no criteria for determining that whatsoever. It goes on to say, quoting again from the paper, the exchange may at a later date determine not to discount such stock or to recognize a discount level that is more or less than 50% of reported eligible gold when calculating deliverable supply estimates. Two things. They're saying estimate. So they're estimating eligible gold, and they're saying that number could go up or down from 50%. Based on what criteria? We don't know. So anybody that's been in this market that has been assuming that the majority of gold that's held on COMEX, which happens to be in the eligible category, in fact, the vast majority, we don't know if it's liquid for delivery, should concern everyone that's made any assumptions on any trade on eligible gold dating back to when they established a category in the early 2000s. That is an astounding revelation. And I don't see the CME Group going to Bloomberg and going to LBMA and say, hey, why don't we retract those previous articles and tell the truth here? Where the hell is that? I don't see that in the public press. And that may be why, you know, people that you've interviewed previously, Tom, don't understand how this works. Because, again, this admission is hidden. It's not in full public view. Is it illegal that the way that they made this admission? No. Is it highly suspect? And does it cause us to question the motives? Yes. I think that's fair.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point to highlight, Rob, is just what we're seeing out of the CME and the COMEX is basically just that there's just so many different things that are suspect, right? So on that line of position limits and stuff, I wanted to talk a little bit about the leverage and basically the reserve requirements in a way, how we could think about this.
So if you don't mind, Tom, there's one more part to this memo and your question around eligible metal. If you don't mind if I answer that first, and then we'll talk about leverage. Okay. So thank you. So in this report, there's another paragraph, much shorter, but no less alarming. And it says the exchange does not currently account for exchange grade gold stock stored at unapproved depositories that can be moved economically into exchange approved facilities. The exchange may at a later date determine to account for such stock when calculating deliverable supply estimates. So your original question was, what about all of these new sources of gold? So they're saying here on April 9th, we're going to go out. And even though we don't know about the chain of integrity of this gold, if these previously unregulated, unapproved depositories, we're going to add a bunch. So they printed a spreadsheet off the CME Group's website. It's called Service Providers, where it talks about gold and silver. And it gives you basically all the gold brands. In other words, all of the people that are approved to provide this 100-ounce gold to the COMEX exchange. At the time that they issued this report, there were, I think, 75. Now there's almost 140. So they've doubled that. Same thing with silver. I think there was something like 70-ish, and now there's 140. So they've doubled the amount of people that they can source gold from to the exchange. So if there had been all this free gold in the market that they could use, that they could either call up from eligible or that they could go source out on the open market, why are they now doubling the amount of people that will provide that gold that were previously unapproved? In other words, it didn't go through their certification process. So again, that's additional information that calls into question the inventories. So I just wanted to point that out. That information is publicly available. Again, I can provide links to Tom so you can provide those to your audience. And if you want to move on to that leverage question, if you'll re-ask that, and then I'll answer that for you.
before we move on to that, let's just highlight a little bit more about the chain of integrity. So if we're all of a sudden approving all kinds of new suppliers that don't necessarily meet the traditional chain of integrity criteria, what's the risk there? Is the risk that we could be starting to maybe see fraudulent suppliers or fraudulent gold bars all of a sudden backing these contracts?
Aha.
Is that a possible risk?
Yes, now you've hit on a major risk. So I'm going to quote from another CME Group thing off their website. It's a PDF. It's called CME Group Precious Metals Physical Delivery Process. And it's printed in March of 2020. I'll give you the link for that one too. This document I've quoted in earlier videos on my channel on YouTube about the delivery cycle, because I wanted to illustrate for people how the cycle worked. But in here, down further in the document, there's a couple of really interesting things. And one of those is the chain of integrity. And in this document, the CME Group tells you how they establish this chain of integrity. And they have approved refiner facilities, approved assayers. Assayer is basically someone who validates that the gold is essentially gold. And it's not like a tungsten gold bar at the center, or what we saw in China recently where they had gold wrapped copper bars. Or it's from another approved depository that also meets those same criteria. So here's a bullet point list of what they do. It says for gold, the inventory may only be delivered to a COMEX approved depository using an approved carrier. That's the person transporting it in one of the following ways: directly from an approved refiner, along with the refiner certificates, directly from an approved assayer with the assay certificates, or directly from another COMEX approved vault. Each gold bar is inspected at the facility. So what they're saying is now they could be sourcing metal that hasn't gone through this process. So we don't know, has it been properly assayed? Is it gold wrapped copper or gold wrapped tungsten? You know, how much confidence do we have in these refiners and assayers? And are they going to apply this product? They're rushing this in so they can get gold to the market. How quickly are they going to be able to provide the certification process? If in the sum of all your years of operating, you had X amount of approved refiners and assayers, and you double that literally in a day, what are the controls around making sure that the gold actually coming in is legitimate gold? That somebody's going to get this in delivery from a contract and they're not going to see, you know, something that's not legitimate gold.
Yeah, and this kind of comes back to the problem of the self-regulation as we were talking about, right?
Yeah, so I'm glad you mentioned that. So in this same document, the role of market regulation. So in the CME Group, there's something called the Market Regulation Department. And on the same presentation, they talk about the role of the Market Regulation Department. And it says the CME Group's Market Regulation Department, and I'm quoting, ensures that all four, the CME, the CBOT, the NYMEX, and the COMEX, of their designated contract markets or DCMs, fulfill their self-regulatory responsibilities. Meaning those markets regulate themselves. The CME Group just ensures that they're fulfilling that. It doesn't say that they're auditing everything that they're doing or they're doing control reviews. Do they? I have no idea. Their key responsibilities, though, here's the key: approve and inspect facilities for physically settled metal products. Notice how they're not auditing the actual metal. They're just approving the facility in which the metal will be stored. They assure the facilities meet exchange rules. And there are a couple other things, but they're not attesting to the fact that they're auditing the actual metal or that they're validating that this metal is legitimate, that it's stored, and that it matches all of the transactions that actually occurred on these markets, the NYMEX, the COMEX, the CBOT, and CME. We're focusing on the COMEX, but there's three other markets here that are also affected. Now, does self-regulation work? So I want to introduce a new piece of evidence in this argument, if you don't mind, Tom. And this is a paper on digitalcommons.law.yale.edu. So in other words, this is on Yale Law's website. It's called The Manipulation of Commodity Futures Prices, the Unprosecutable Crime. It's written by Jerry Markham. It's a 500-page report. In this report, he goes on to detail how the entire reason all of the rules exist, the Commodities Exchange Act, the CFTC, everything exists is because of a previous manipulation case. So we have had manipulation in our commodities markets dating back to the late 1800s. So the norm has been for these markets to be manipulated. And every rule that exists is a result of some manipulative scheme. The CFTC was created in the late 1960s, early 1970s, after the Commodities Exchange Act failed to properly regulate the market as the regulatory body. And in this paper, he goes on to outline how the CFTC has failed. They're not given enough power. There's not enough independent auditing, all those types of things. And that has caused what they call in the paper a crisis of confidence. We had a crisis of confidence in the 1970s. They established a CFTC. We still have a crisis of confidence. And in this paper, he goes on to note that there were back when the original Commodities Exchange Act was created, and when that failed before they created the CFTC, Congress got involved because people were saying the commodities markets are rigged. They're rigged. So that Congress got involved, and there was a Senate report that said self-regulation doesn't work. So that's why we created the CFTC. Okay, let's go back to the role of the CME group. Their markets, the CME, the CBOT, NYMEX, and COMEX are self-regulated. And the market regulation department at CME Group is not regulating them by their own admission. So my question is, where is the CFTC? If we know from all dating all the way back 50 years to the 1970s and that Senate report that self-regulation doesn't work and we shouldn't trust self-regulation, and I can attest to that as an auditor, you look at what happened at Enron, where is the CFTC in all this? Why are they allowing the CME Group, the four exchanges, to self-regulate? Again, all sorts of questions about why this occurs when we know that this scheme doesn't work over time. And it calls into question every piece of data that gets reported about these markets. How do we know that this is valid data? How do we know this information is correct?
Yeah, there's just so many pieces of evidence that point towards some kind of ulterior motive by making things opaque and hard to understand, right?
Yeah, and who's responsible for that ulterior motive is often the subject of a lot of conspiracy theory, and happy to talk about that. But without the transactional data, we don't know. We don't know, is it the bullion banks? Is it customers that the bullion banks represent? Is it sovereigns coming in? Is China stealing our gold through this market? Because in this market, foreign bodies can come in, and they can be represented by one of these bullion banks. It could be foreign bodies pulling gold out of our markets. And that's perfectly within the rules. This is not only a United States exchange. There can be foreign transactions. So you had asked me earlier about leverage. So I wanted to bring in one more piece of data, if you don't mind, relating to commitment of traders. So now we're adding another layer onto this. The CME Group's not the only one that reports data about these markets. The CFTC, the regulatory body, does a commitment of traders report. In the commitment of traders report, they break down at an aggregate level who's taking positions long and short. So you have the producer merchant category, which are what I talked about would be legitimate hedges. You know, the producer's making the stuff or the merchant's using it, and they have to hedge their price risk between the time that, you know, stuff is planted or mined to the time that it's actually in the end product. There's all sorts of price risk along that supply chain. So that's what the market was originally intended for. But in addition to that, you have what's called the swap dealers, which are the bullion banks. These are the big banks that hold these massive short positions in gold and silver. Then you have the moneyed interest, you know, the hedge funds and all that kind of stuff. They're the money managers. And then you have other reportables. Other reportables are like wealthy individuals that are large enough to actually trade these markets, 100 ounce gold or 5,000 ounce silver. If you look at the COT report, the commitment and trader report, the amount of shorts on silver, for example, within the last year has been 10 times the amount of global annual production. Global annual production. Not all of the silver in the world flows through the COMEX. But on the COMEX, we're trading 10 times global world production. And I want to point out something here. When you take a futures market position, you can take it years in advance if you want, but typically it's 2 to 3 months, 4 months sometimes. So why in a 2 to 3 to 4 month time frame do we have the entire global production of silver hedged 10 times over? What's the point of that? What happens there is the shorts on those positions then become naked. Any short position, whether it be the stock market or a futures market, that's not backed up by the actual product. In the stock market, it would be the stock. In the futures market, it would be the metal. Where that is not backed up by an equal physical position of metal, it's called a naked short. That has the effect of bringing the price down. So that anybody that then takes delivery, whoever it is, which has usually been the bullion banks and the other reportables, and sometimes the merchants, are getting the metal at a cheaper price because of all that short paper. So in other words, that's where the exchange has acted as a speculative market, which allows controlling and moving the price around for the benefit of certain players on the market. The problem I have with that is this goes to determining, you know, the gold and silver prices everybody uses, whether we're buying a piece of jewelry, we're investing in a gold bar, or the manufacturers are using it to produce televisions, silver in the televisions, or Apple's using it to produce their iPhones. That affects billions of dollars of transactions on a daily basis. And that's really what I have a problem with in terms of the leverage. It's an over-leveraged market. And what that leverage also does is it obscures the physical trade, because the way the CME Group reports the numbers, all of that paper and that physical is not broken down into separate columns on a daily basis, where you can say such and such trader came in and got this much physical and such trader came in and got this much paper. And there's another point about that getting into shadow contracts. How many people are doing that where they're coming in same day and pulling gold and silver off the market? And that's basically what gets into Kirian Van Hess argument about what they're doing and getting the metal off the market in a rush, because I think a lot of market participants don't think that the metal is there.
Absolutely. And that's obviously a symptom of A, people not thinking it's there and wanting to take delivery while they still can, and B, the confidence or lack thereof in basically holding the fiat currency, right?
Right, exactly.
So the point you just made there, Rob, I kind of want to drill into a little bit more. The reason all of this is so important is because the COMEX basically drives what most people consider to be the spot price of gold and silver. Most people use that to price that metal. So why is it that the COMEX is the main driver of the price discovery in those metals?
Okay, so the spot price of metal is actually determined in London, but that data is so opaque that you can't get it. You have to pay something like $18,000 a year to get any access to LBMA data. So it's very opaque. So people come to the COMEX and use that as their gold price and silver price discovery mechanism because they actually produce data. And it's not the greatest data in the world, but it's more data than any other gold market. So it's like the default. If you're going to take a futures position, you're going to, you know, you're going to use the COMEX data to do it. And it, for most part, I think the spreads between the London spot and the COMEX aren't that wide because they work together. We just can't see that. So what we have to use is what's going on in the COMEX. We can't see what's going on in London. So we use the COMEX. The reason people use that market is also the most liquid. It trades on the Globex. It's available most of the day. Like I said, foreign transactions, anybody can come and use it. So it's the closest thing to a worldwide gold futures market that we have. And even though the data is spotty, at least some of it's available. I think it's misleading, but that's why that market is being used. What this points to is a bigger global issue. If you can't get the data off a London market, how do you know that any of that data is correct that they report? What about the Shanghai? The Shanghai has an issue reporting because all they do is report basically the open interest. They don't report the volumes and the physically stored gold. So even if you're using the COMEX and you have all these worldwide players making trades, but you can't see all the rest of the gold and silver trade around the world, you're using flawed data. Does it make sense? Because you don't know how your futures that you're trading on COMEX is going to be affected by all these other markets that have opaque data. So while people do use the COMEX because it trades more hours of the day and it has some data available, that's flawed data in and of itself.
Perfect. So Rob, in your opinion, what is the end game here? And I know we can get into a couple more kind of definitions here and the legality side of contracts and the seller dictating the actual terms of the contract. But
yes.
Maybe let's start there. Let's start with what happens when the COMEX isn't going to be able to deliver on the physical side of these contracts if people want to take delivery.
So it had been previously stated in an interview that you had with a gentleman back on September 11th, Tom. He was talking about how the sellers dictate the trade. He actually corrected himself. He initially said the seller dictates, and then he corrected himself and said the seller initiates. So one thing that I wanted to point out, the Uniform Commercial Code governs contracts. So does the Constitution. And you have to have two sides to agree to a contract. So the seller or buyer should not be able to dictate. If anybody's manipulating a market to dictate price, that violates not only the Uniform Commercial Code, but the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 10, the obligation of contracts. And the Uniform Commercial Code, UCC, which you can view by going to Cornell Law, and you can see that there are all sorts of rules about how contracts should be negotiated. And there has to be agreement on both sides. So the seller doesn't dictate the contract. They do initiate the delivery process. But whether or not you're going to get gold delivery or whether or not you're going to settle for cash is determined at the time the contract's negotiated. So the buyer and seller both have to agree. So if the seller comes in and they're saying, I want to issue only paper contracts, and the buyer's like, yeah, I don't want to take that, then you have no contract. Okay, now fast forward to the shadow contracts. What Kieran Von Hess pointed out was that people are coming doing same-day contracts. So longs are coming in and getting shorts to agree to do delivery within the delivery month. So in other words, you can come into the September contract right now, and you can do this up until September 28th, by the way. So we've got 12 more days. You can go in and say, I want a contract and I want it deliverable tomorrow. As long as you have a short willing to do that, you can take gold off the market right then. That's not what the futures markets were intended for. But they're doing that because I think that there's a gold and silver squeeze going on. Now, I can't prove it because I don't have the data. And that's the problem. We don't have the data. But the behavior of the COMEX in questioning their own eligible liquid gold and basically confirming for us that maybe none of that eligible will ever see the market again, that determines on who holds title to it. the fact that they're going out and getting these previously unapproved assayers and refiners in without necessarily having all those previous controls over the quality of the gold. The fact that they're doing this contract with London called an ACE, where they're trying to use London 400 ounce bars, but nobody's actually falling for that scheme and actually delivering that. It's only happened 32 times. You know, all these schemes to try to bolster what the perception of the gold is. But you see in the markets that people are coming and getting same day delivery. And when I say same day, I mean within 24 to 48 hours. So people aren't treating the futures market as a future market anymore. They're coming in treating it as a spot market. That's what the shadow contracts is all about. That indicates that the gold and silver is not there. And again, we don't have a published audit on the actual depositories and what gold and silver is actually there. And we don't have any sort of auditing done by the CFTC, at least published to show that the numbers are correct and the gold and silver is there. So what I think the end game is that people are panicked and they're taking as much gold and silver off the market as they can. And how much we actually have, no one knows. No one can come on your program and tell us how much gold and silver there is unless there's an audit and you have a reputable firm go and figure all that out. And so there's a panic. Now, are we actually going to run out of gold by the time we get to December contract? Maybe. I've speculated that December, we may run out of gold and silver, at least whatever's liquid. People are going to hold on to it and they're not going to release it because there's 400,000 open contracts in gold and over 100,000 in silver. That's a lot. Because a contract in silver is 5,000 ounces and a contract in gold is 100 ounces. That represents a lot of gold and silver. And depending on how many people stand for delivery, if the COMEX doesn't actually have the liquid gold in the registered category for it, you can have a run on the COMEX just like you have a run on your bank. If you go to your bank and they only have 1/10 of the physical cash available because of fractional reserve, once that 1/10 is gone, the other 9/10 of people come to get their cash, it's not there. That's called a bank run. Well, the same thing could happen on COMEX. You could have a gold and silver run where people stand for delivery and it's not there. And then what happens to the exchange? Is it still a legitimate exchange because there's no physical metal? Go back to the original reason the exchange exists, legitimate price hedging, and also delivery of the physical, by the way, for people that want it. So if there's no more physical, then it just becomes a paper casino, essentially. It becomes a pure derivative, a pure bet, like you're going to Las Vegas and you're betting on, you know, the price of Tesla tomorrow. And I don't know whether that stands up as a legitimate market. I don't know if then COMEX fails to be seen across the world as a legitimate market. And if COMEX is the only one that's really seen as the transparent market now and that collapses, what happens to gold and silver prices across the world? You could see a fundamental sea change in the way that people value gold and silver. And we don't know if that's going to happen. We're going to have to wait till December to see. But what Karian Von Hess pointed out, and he tracked this all the way back to the spring, by the way, people are going for immediate delivery. They're scared. They're trying to get it. And that has not stopped. That has actually intensified over the last few months.
So when you're saying people are trying to take delivery, obviously we're not necessarily thinking about the average Joe trying to take a 100 ounce contract of gold to be delivered, never mind, you know, thousands of them or 5,000 ounce contract of silver. So is there any way to know if it's like an institution that's trying to take delivery or who is actually trying to take physical delivery in these larger quantities like this?
No, because the only people that know that are the people doing the trades, the CFTC, the COMEX, and God. Those are the only four people that would know those numbers because there's nothing printed that tells us that. If you go back to the argument on the CME Group data, they do not provide transactional level information. It's all aggregated. And some of it only is provided for a day at a time, like the metal delivery reports. And some of it's only provided for 5 days at a time, including the open interest and what they're calling volume, which is not actually volume. It's not true volume. But those are aggregate numbers. Underneath that, you can't do a transactional level. The only thing you can do is go to the CFTC's COT report. That's Commitment of Traders. They do aggregate reporting for producer merchants, bullion banks, which are the swap dealers, the moneyed interest, the hedge managers and those types, the financial types on Wall Street, and the other reportables, the very wealthy individuals that trade on this market. But it's only an aggregate. You can't tell it's John Doe or it's specifically JP Morgan or HSBC. Now, some people have said they believe JP Morgan was shorting silver and they were doing it for their own book. They're surmising that, but there's no data. Now, does it flow through JP Morgan's trading account? Sure. Who's behind that? Is it JP Morgan? Is it the United States government? Is it China? Is it a bunch of wealthy traders? Is it producers and merchants? We don't know. The one thing I'll say is this. If there's a producer merchant category and those are legitimate hedges and those are called out in the Commitment of Traders reports and everybody else is a speculator, and they're taking the majority of the transactions. It's not for legitimate purposes that this trading is going on, for legitimate hedging at least. It's for some other purpose. Now, as to what that is, the data will not tell you. As to who that is, the data will not tell you. And that's why the audits are important. If you got an auditor in there and they looked at the last 10 years worth of data and had the transactional ledger data, they could tell you exactly what's going on and they could tell you who's doing it. And I actually, the funny thing is, Tom, the editors of one of the places I published my original article about the numbers not adding up asked me to contact the CME group and sort it out with them. So I emailed the CME group last week and I spoke to two people. And I challenged them. They said, you're wrong. And I said, fine, prove it. Walk me through the numbers. Provide me just a line level analyst. You know, it doesn't have to be a director or anything like that. Just give me, you know, one of your analysts to walk me through the numbers. They refused. They still have not answered that request. They have publicly said that I'm wrong, but they refused to provide detail. They refused to provide detail on what the actual volume numbers are. I asked them point blank, what are the volume numbers? They won't tell me. So they won't balance the numbers. The CME group has failed to answer the question. If the CME group feels as though this information is wrong and it could be damaging to them, to the perception of their markets and their ability to manage those markets, why don't they just come out and answer the question? That's what I don't understand, Tom.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Rob. And again, we're trying to see and highlight this argument from all sides and really distill this information in the best way we can. And it just seems so difficult to get any real answer from the CME group as towards why we can't have clear and easy to understand information on these accounting summaries, let's say, of where this stuff is and what's actually there, right?
Yeah, we have it in corporate America. We have Sarbanes-Oxley regulating that. Why don't we have it in the commodities markets? Somebody please explain that to me. Why is this not necessary? Why is it not necessary for the public to understand this? If you're talking about the price of gold and silver across the world that goes into our economy, billions of dollars, why can't we have this? Also, if you talk about, you know, these markets, they're exchanging a lot of other stuff. They're exchanging a lot of other goods, sugar, oil, energy, wheat. Why don't we have it? I mean, think about in 2018, the Bureau of Economic Analysis said that there's $893 billion of commodities used up in the American economy. That's not the end product value. That's the value of the raw commodities. The end product value is going to be in the trillions. We're talking about trillions of dollars of trade going on in the United States alone, in which we do not have valid data to know if the price discovery mechanism is correct. That's an issue. It's not just in gold and silver. It's across the commodities complex. I'm just highlighting the gold and silver stuff because that's what I happen to write about. It's what I have an interest in. But if you apply this to the other markets, it's the same issue. The implications of this, Tom, are astounding. And I think that's why I'm not getting the response from the CME group. They don't want me digging. Nobody wants an auditor to come in and prove the truth. Enron didn't want it. But that's why we have Sarbanes-Oxley, because we need it. Because to have a functioning, stable, free market economy, you have to have truth and transparency. And if you don't, people aren't going to trust it and your economy is going to collapse when you have questions about it.
Absolutely, Rob. As you say, it doesn't provide any confidence for the way that these pricing mechanisms and the price discovery of these valuable assets are. Anything else that we missed that you'd like to highlight, Rob?
Boy, I think we covered a whole bunch on the interview today, Tom. I think between this interview and the great questions you had and all the documents I'll provide you, I think there's a lot for people to kind of bite off. And I know it's a lot for people to understand who may not be as familiar with the market. So I'd like to invite people to email me. And, you know, if there's any sort of appetite for it, Tom, I'd like to come back on at some point in the future and maybe address some additional questions if you feel like that would make sense.
Yeah, we can absolutely entertain that. What's your email, Rob, in case anybody does want to get in touch with you?
Sure. It's robert@goldsilverpros.com. And you can see all of my video and article work at goldsilverpros.com or on my YouTube channel.
And you're also at Gold Silver Pros on Twitter.
That's correct.
Perfect. Thanks for your time today, Rob. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. And further, I wanted to state that I appreciate you bringing all of the sides of this argument together so that people can listen to your program and really sort of make up their own minds. I think this is what's not happened before. And I think you're serving a vital and important role here. And I do appreciate you inviting me on your program.
Well, I think it's valuable to really not try and stay in our echo chamber of gold, silver bulls. And this is, again, like I've said so many times, that this is such a complex and opaque issue that we need to be able to have reasonable discussions around it, look at it from my perspective, your perspective, and everybody else's perspective that has studied this and that knows anything about it. And as you say, make up our minds about it from there. So absolutely love your feedback and love to have you on again. Thanks, Rob.
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?